some wonderful stories about his far-flung knowledge about 19th century theater. But he is best known for his work on stage and film versions of Shakespeare. He has edited a collection of meaty essays, The Cambridge Companion to Shakespeare on Film, and co-edited the Oxford Illustrated History of Shakespeare on Stage. For obvious reasons, some of his work is linked to Stratford and the Royal Shakespeare Company. I got to know him when he reviewed the RSC Stratford season for Shakespeare Quarterly for roughly a decade. Now, he wrote some wonderful reviews, detailed, thoughtful. His 2003 book on Romeo and Juliet examines 15 RSC productions between 1947 and 2000 in an attempt, and I quote, to measure the ground traveled not only in terms of response to the script in question, but as evidence of changes in theatrical and social sensibilities. Recently, he published Shakespeare Films in the Making, Vision, Production, and Reception, Cambridge University Press, 2007, a thoughtful and detailed study of five 20th century movies, Max Reinhardt's 1935 Midsummer Night's Dream, Laurence Olivier's 1944 Henry V, and three film versions of Romeo and Juliet, climaxing with the 1968 Zeffirelli production. In each case, he concentrates on what he terms the dream of each film, along with the particular circumstances and, a quote, the wider issues of cultural authority invoked by a playwright's name and status. To focus on these publications, however, is only to tell part of the story. Since the mid-1980s, Professor Jackson has worked as text advisor with Kenneth Branagh on stage and radio productions and on all of his Shakespeare films, and also on Oliver Parker's Othello with Kenneth Branagh and Lawrence Fishburne, and John Madden's Shakespeare in Love. If you know the published screenplay of Branagh's Hamlet, you may have enjoyed, as I did, his production diary that serves as an appendix. In these activities, he has proved to be one of those rare academics who bridges the chasm in the far-flung Shakespeare industry between scholarship and professional performance. No mean accomplishment, as I can attest from my own struggles to do the same. To end on a less substantive note, Professor Jackson's listed academic degrees and honors include the usual alphabet soup, MA, PhD, and so on, but also letters new to me as a non-speaker of UK English, FRSA. Even I know that the letter F can denote fellow of, but the RSA, in my experience, here in the provinces, is the Renaissance Society of America. I see various members of that group out in the audience. However, I discovered that RSA, in this instance, stands for the Royal Society of Arts, which in turn is the short version of the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures, and Commerce, described as a British multidisciplinary institution based in London. It was founded in 1754 and was granted a royal charter in 1847. Notable members have included Ben Franklin, Karl Marx, Adam Smith, William Hogarth, and Charles Dickens. That's quite a list. Notwithstanding its establishment credentials, the RSA, according to its website, has always been a radical body which has sought to challenge the status quo and change the world around in order to, quote, remove the barriers to social progress. Its founders spoke of the need to embolden enterprise, enlarge science, refine art, improve our manufactures, and extend our commerce, but also of the need to alleviate poverty and secure full employment. I cite this material for two reasons. First, because in our current climate, we seem to be obsessed with conspiracy theories linked to secret societies. Think of the Da Vinci Code, black helicopters, and the New World Order. So that association with this RSA might loom for some of you as a dark cloud. And second, because of Professor Jackson's announced topic for this evening. I am therefore pleased to introduce Professor Russell Jackson, who will speak to us about sensational Shakespeare. Thank you.
In the interests of furthering manufacturers, I should point out I'm holding a copy of the Folger Shakespeare Hamlet, which I bought just an hour ago when I realized I couldn't remember a quotation. So there we are. Highly recommended. First a prologue, then another prologue, and an explanation. This is the title of the lecture. There will be no other slides, so don't get your hopes up. But we thought it'd be better for you to look at that than at a blue screen that is one of those screens that reveals what else people have on their laptops, which are part of the presentation mode of modern living. The other thing I should mention, and it's beginning to sound rather like saying, when I was a lad, it was all fields around here, is that when I first came to Washington and to the Folger in 1973, two extraordinary events were beginning to unfold. And one of them has a strange echo nowadays. When I arrived, A.L. Rouse had discovered the identity of the Dark Lady of the Sonnets, Emilia Lania, because she was brown in her youth. Professor Stanley Wells came out with a very succinct observation based on actually looking a little more closely at Simon Forman's manuscript diaries in the Bodleian Library, that she was very brave in her youth, therefore not so obviously a dark lady as one might think. And there was this revelation of Rouse's and the counter-revelation of Stanley Wells sort of brings to mind what's being said about a portrait I'm not going to say any more about right now. The other minor matter that was unfolding is that when I arrived, people said, not, oh, you're here just in time for the controversy about the Dark Lady. They said, this Watergate thing's really going to get big. Now, I left 6 weeks later and they said, it's a shame you're going because this Watergate thing's really getting big. Anyway. So, let's move to matters of high importance. The scene is a young man about town's flat somewhere in London in the 1920s or 30s. And breakfast has just been served and consumed. "These eggs, Jeeves," I said. "Very good, very tasty." "Yes, sir?" "Laid, no doubt, by contented hens. And the coffee, perfect. Nor must I omit to give a word of praise to the bacon. I wonder if you notice anything about me this morning." "You seem in very good spirits, sir." "Yes, Jeeves, I am happy today. I'm very glad to hear it, sir. You might say I'm sitting on top of the world with a rainbow round my shoulder. A most satisfactory state of affairs, sir." "What's the word I've heard you use from time to time? Begins with U, U. Euphoria, sir? That's the one. I've seldom had a sharper attack of euphoria. I feel full to the brim of vitamin B. Mind you, I don't know how long it will last. Too often it is when one feels fizziest that the storm clouds begin doing their stuff." "Very true, sir. Full many a glorious morning have I seen flatter the mountain tops with sovereign eye, kissing with golden face the meadows green, gilding pale streams with heavenly alchemy, anon permit the basest clouds to ride with ugly rack on his celestial face, and from the forlorn world his visage hide, stealing unseen to west with this disgrace." "Exactly," I said. "Couldn't have put it better myself. One always has to budget for a change in the weather. Sometimes the sudden shock of Shakespeare, the sensation of citation, comes as an agreeable surprise. I'll be returning to this kind of sensational Shakespeare at the end of this talk. But for the intervening time, with what may be more illustration than analysis, I want to celebrate sensational effects produced by the work of today's birthday boy. A few years ago, I went to the box office at the Royal Shakespeare Theatre to buy tickets for A Midsummer Night's Dream. "I must tell you," said the ticket seller, "that the production is in modern dress and that it contains nudity and scenes of an explicit sexual nature." Well, I resisted the temptation to say, "That's just what I expected," or what actually came to my mind was, "I should hope so." After all, this is a play whose dealings with sex and violence have become something of a critical cliché. And I had recently seen a production in Berlin where the lovers were all dead on stage and covered in blood by the end of the first part, having taken guns and knives to each other during their adventures in the wood. They recover because it's a fairy play, so it's all right. But it's the need to give a warning, though, which is particularly significant. No one expects to be told in the theatre that they may be bored or mildly annoyed for an inordinate amount of the evening, or that the auditorium has been decorated in one of the vilest hues known to interior decorating. Audiences nowadays do expect to be told about gunfire and strobe lighting and dry ice, vaporised oil, for the sake of their health. And indeed, people are already being warned in Noel Coward plays that smoking takes place, although they're not told that there will be petulant slamming of doors. The sex and violence warning came out. Oh, DVDs, by the way. My favourite warning on a DVD so far was a biblical epic, which warned parents that there was mild peril. It's the crucifixion. The sex and violence warning came after a school teacher, in one of those well-publicised gestures of outrage, had protested that his or her charges had been exposed to the corrupting influence of the fairy play by the RSC's sensation mongers. The modern dress element of the list is there for those, in what was the warning given at the box office, for those who expect what goes on at Stratford-on-Avon to be somehow traditional, that is, sartorially and sexually straight. I wonder whether they should just put up a sign with Horatio's lines from the end of Hamlet, promising carnal, bloody, and unnatural acts. I shan't develop this particular theme right now, but I think it's in the spirit of such warnings I should announce that the following lecture contains explicit sexual acts, not enacted, described, copious bloodshed and acts of violence, and some bad language. It will be delivered in modern dress. Well, sort of. My topic is sensational Shakespeare. I shall be looking at the different ways in which sensation might be defined in the context of Shakespearean interpretation, mainly in theatrical performances of Shakespeare's plays, although I'll also be discussing some accounts of the experience of reading Shakespeare and some of the ways in which what we might call the sensation of Shakespeare has been sneaked up on audiences and readers unawares when the works of Shakespeare were not the main business in hand, such as, for example, Woodhouse's wonderful use of the sonnet in the piece I just read. Defining sensation in this context is a tricky undertaking, which I intend to duck almost completely. But at one level, it takes in the element of spectacle, surprise, and narrative contrivance given to it by the Victorian novel and the Victorian stage. I never travel without my diary, says Gwendolyn, in The Importance of Being Earnest. One should always have something sensational to read in the train. Victorian sensation novels are so-called not merely because they involved hairbreadth escapes in the face of a deadly imminent oncoming train or saw blade, but because of the highly wrought emotional crises that accompany such events and to which they are a climax. Like the disaster movie, they were susceptible of variation, elaboration, and parody. They provided a guilty pleasure. And there was always a double to the emotional experience. The spectators are now, for disaster movies, and were then, for sensation novels and melodramas, engaged by the ways in which the effects had been achieved, as well as the sensations they enjoyed. This element of the so-called cinema of attractions has influenced Shakespearean filmmaking. Events off-staged or described in the theatre need to be seen to be believed in the cinema. Orson Welles's Battle of Shrewsbury in Chimes at Midnight, the Agincourts, respectively Sunny and Muddy, of Olivier and Branagh, and the wastelands in which Brooks' filmic King Lear unfolds, and which in Kozintsev's far more political historical version of the same play, Civil War has reduced the kingdom to. These are cinematic sensations responding to elements in Shakespeare, but going far beyond them in aim, according to the aims and methods of film. The vivid filmic imagery in which Julie Taymor developed on film for corresponding images in her stage version in New York of Titus Andronicus, in itself an inescapably sensational play, offer a remarkable recent example. We could go on, but don't worry, we won't be doing. We could go on to consider other kinds of sensational filmmaking that depend on qualities in the plays. From the film noir Freudian nightmare of George Cukor's A Double Life, with Ronald Coleman as an actor who really should not play Othello, to the tacky, because you end up strangling Shelley Winters, to the tacky pleasures of Vincent Price as a vengeful ham in Theatre of Blood. We could talk about those all night. However, let me begin with Shakespeare's effect in the study a little while back in the less obviously sensational arena of privacy. Samuel Johnson, in a famous note in his 1765 edition of Shakespeare's works, describes how Nahum Tate's adaptation of King Lear, with its relatively happy ending, Cordelia not dead and ready to marry Edgar, Gloucester blinded but alive and off to meditative retirement with Lear, had held the stage since 1700. With his characteristic shrewd combination of moral judgment and the sense of a reader's or spectator's preferences and needs, Dr. Johnson justifies Tate's revision of the play's ending on aesthetic grounds. A play, he writes, in which the wicked prosper and the virtuous miscarry may doubtless be good because it is a just representation of the common events of human life. You might say the vanity of human wishes. But since all reasonable beings naturally love justice, I cannot easily be persuaded that the observation of justice makes a play worse, or that if other excellences are equal, the audience will not always rise better pleased from the final triumph of persecuted virtue. Having recorded that since the time of Nahum Tate's version, Cordelia has always retired with victory and felicity, Johnson adds a confession that gives one of, as one of those sudden images of a reader's private experience. If my sensations could add anything to the general suffrage, I might relate that I was many years ago so shocked by Cordelia's death that I know not whether I ever endured to read again the last scenes of the play until I undertook to revise them as an editor. What is so striking here is the intense personal investment in achieving a sense of stability and concord. It's as though Johnson's emotional needs, which were formidable, have been revealed in this extraordinary instance as necessitating his neoclassical rationale for a happy ending, a virtual admission that retirement with victory and felicity is a consummation devoutly to be wished, but rarely achieved outside the realm of art. When Johnson insists on the appropriateness of the familiar stage adaptation's relatively happy and certainly resolved ending to the play, he's fully aware of the alternatives that real life would afford. No one would have occurred more wholeheartedly than Johnson with Miss Prism's remark in The Importance of Being Earnest about her novel, the disappeared novel that was exchanged for a baby, the good ended happily and the bad unhappily. That is what fiction means. My second reader is the great actress Sarah Siddons. As the cultivation of private emotions and their expression began to prevail as a defining mode for artistic and emotional experience, sensibility with a capital S, accounts of reading Shakespeare became more intense and personal, and in some cases positively gothic. In 1779, Sarah Siddons had been persuaded to take on a role that she was later associated with. Her Lady Macbeth was one of the defining interpretations of the role and also of her line of parts. Her description of a solitary late-night reading of the play was quoted by her biographer Thomas Campbell. "I went on," she said, "with tolerable composure, in the silence of the night, a night I can never forget, till I came to the assassination scene, when the horrors of the scene rose to a degree that made it impossible for me to get further. I snatched up my candle, and hurrying out of the room in a paroxysm of terror, My dress was of silk, and the rustling of it, as I ascended the stairs to go to bed, seemed to my panic-stricken fancy like the movement of a spectre pursuing me. At last I reached my chamber, where I found my husband fast asleep. I clapped my candlestick down upon the table without the power of putting the candle out, and I threw myself on my bed without daring to stay, even to take off my clothes." Siddons may sound rather like Jane Austen's Catherine, convinced of ghostly terrors and dark family secrets haunting Northanger Abbey, but the state of mind, the intensity is quite extraordinary, and also quite extraordinary is the way that this sense of the numinous and the threatening powers beyond her mental control seems to have informed her acting, an aspect of her acting that was finely captured in Fuseli's paintings and drawings. The romantic experience of Shakespeare produced some remarkable accounts of stage performance by critics in terms of emotional sensation, and in the case of the tragedies, the terrific power that might be realized in the theater. Thomas de Quincey's attempt to account for the sensations caused by the knocking at the gate in Macbeth relate to the effect of performances in general rather than to specific performances. But this was also a period of vivid and detailed reviewing. Interestingly though, William Hazlitt and Charles Lamb, both enthusiastic theatergoers, wrote feelingly of the unavoidable gap between the ideal images of A Midsummer Night's Dream and King Lear and the inadequate representation of them afforded in the theatre. Coleridge's great contribution to the interpretation of Shakespeare amounts to a redefinition of reading, strictly speaking, rather than watching or listening. For Keats, sitting down to read King Lear once again means shutting the olden pages of golden-tongued romance in order to burn through the fierce dispute betwixt damnation and impassioned clay. Invoking the chief poet and the clouds of Albion as begetters of our deep eternal theme, the whole of Keats's sonnet on sitting down to read King Lear again is effectively a supplication, and it concludes with a famous plea. When through the old oak forest I am gone, let me not wander in a barren dream. But when I am consumed in the fire, give me new phoenix wings to fly at my desire. Reading the play is an ordeal from which he hopes, or expects, as he's been there before anyway, to emerge renewed and enhanced. Could the unavoidably social circumstances of the theatre accommodate such cathartic experiences? Could that invocation of the mythological and fairy tale world of the old oak forest survive in the paint and canvas of the stage? If we're to judge by the French composer Hector Berlioz, they certainly could. In his case, it was a potent brew of undiluted Shakespeare in English, even though he couldn't actually understand the dialogue, and an Irish actress, Harriet Smithson, with whom he fell passionately in love. Never one to undersell his feelings, Berlioz describes the effect in his memoirs. Seeing an English company perform Shakespeare in Paris completely transformed his sense of what was possible. Shakespeare, he said, coming upon me unawares, struck me like a thunderbolt. The lightning flash of that discovery revealed to me at a stroke the whole heaven of art, illuminating it to its remotest corners. After seeing Hamlet, Berlioz then went on to see Romeo and Juliet. This produced in him what can only be described as a fine frenzy rolling. To steep myself in the fiery sun and balmy nights of Italy, to witness the drama of that immense love, swift as thought, burning as lava, radiantly pure as an angel's glance, imperious, irresistible, the raging hatreds, the wild ecstatic kisses, the desperate strife of love and death contending for mastery. It was too much. By the third act, hardly able to breathe, as though an iron hand gripped me by the heart, I knew that I was lost. The experience led directly to a great deal of extraordinary music, notably the Symphonie Fantastique, and a disastrous marriage between the composer and the actress he was watching. It may seem appropriate to follow this with a less elevated example of what reading Shakespeare might do to a carefully cultivated romantic temperament, in this case one driven a few years later more by fashion than by intellect. "I'm always ill after Shakespeare," said Mrs. Wititterly. This is in Nicholas Nickleby. "I scarcely exist the next day. I find the reaction so very great after a tragedy, and Shakespeare is such a delicious creature. Do you know, I find I take so much more interest in his plays after having been to that dear, dull little house he was born in. I don't know how it is, but after you've seen the place and written your name in the little book, somehow or other you seem to be inspired. It kindles up quite a fire within." Shakespeare might also focus an intellectual sense of his or her personal identity, offering a confirmation of what had been suspected or a clarification of what has not been apprehended, clearly until now. Among the documented experiences of solitary readers, one of the most remarkable in the 19th century is that of John Addington Symonds, a great scholar and critic of the Italian Renaissance. Author of a magisterial account of that, and of essays on Shakespeare and his predecessors in the drama. He compiled an autobiography, which was unsurprisingly unpublished during his lifetime. He describes what Venus and Adonis could do for a young lad in the early 1850s. Symonds explains that he used to have dreams or half dreams just before sleeping, in which, to quote, "I used to fancy myself crouched upon the floor amid a company of naked adult men, sailors such as I had seen about the streets of Bristol." I did warn you, by the way. "The contact of their bodies afforded me a vivid and mysterious pleasure." He benefited little from his other commonplace childhood experiences of sex, which I shan't particularize just now. He does, very fully. Nevertheless, his own urges and the visions remained vague and inexplicable. Then sometime before the age of 10, he read Venus and Adonis. It gave form, he writes, ideality and beauty to my previous erotic visions. Those adult males, the shaggy and brawny sailors, without entirely disappearing, began to be superseded in my fancy by an adolescent Adonis. In some confused way, I identified myself with Adonis, but at the same time I yearned after him as an adorable object of passionate love. Venus only served to intensify that situation. I did not pity her. I did not want her. I did not think that had I been in the position of Adonis, I should have used his opportunities to better purpose. No, she only expressed my own relationship to the desirable male. She brought into relief the overwhelming attraction of masculine adolescence and its proud sexual ardor. I dreamed of falling back like her upon the grass and folding the quick panting lad in my arms. He wasn't moved at all by the rape of Lucrece. Just as well. I took Venus and Adonis, he wrote, in the way Shakespeare undoubtedly meant it to be taken. Depends which portrait you're looking at, I suppose. Now, I know of no comparable acknowledgement of this kind from the Victorian period, even though there's ample evidence from the monarch herself to the compiler of the Chartist Shakespearean hymn book of the impact of Shakespeare on Victoria's subjects. It seems appropriate to consider the place reading Shakespeare out loud might have in the family circle. It was a common Victorian activity, perhaps not entirely dead a century later. But it was for the benefit of exactly such family activities, parlour activities, that Bowdler's notorious Family Shakespeare, with its careful expurgations and alterations, was published, and indeed did a great service. We think of it in terms of excision and suppression, but also it was an enabling tool, so to speak, for the family. It was for these kind of families that Bowdler's work was done, but the drawing room I want to visit is admittedly a rather more intense one, that of the composer Richard Wagner and his wife Cosima. Their tastes were comprehensive, and they certainly didn't balk at unpleasant plays. On the 14th of May, 1874, the Wagners, apparently alone and without the children, read Titus Andronicus, but, writes Cosima, with some distaste. The next day, they discussed their preferences. Richard says that when we last read Lear, the tremendous mounting tension, the coming and going, the scene division, the tremendous rapidity combined with an overall leisureliness had made quite a unique impression on him. Otherwise, Othello lay closest to his heart. In this case, the experience of reading King Lear seems to have produced sensations akin to those cultivated in Wagner's own operatic work. That's a tremendous rapidity combined with an overall leisureliness that we know and love. It is perhaps unsurprising, though, that the great play of sexual jealousy, Othello, was closest to Wagner's heart because he was a great one for him, both engendering it and experiencing it. In November 1881, when the composer was working on Parsifal, he and his wife relaxed in the evenings, as you would by reading the Henry VI plays out loud. Or rather, to get the full picture of this domestic idyll, Wagner read and she listened. 8th of November 1881, says Cosima's diary. Richard reads to us the second act of Henry VI, Part I, again making an indescribable impact, especially the scene involving the brawl with the roses. It is impossible to speak of anything else. When I say to Richard that the play with the symbolic roses reminds one of Tristan und Isolde, the torch, he says, yes, it is musical. The diary for the next day suggests a resemblance between the world of Shakespeare's histories and that of the Ring of the Nibelung, rather than of Tristan. 23rd of November, 1881, we finish Henry VI, horrified by the world Shakespeare has given us. Now, if we move from readers to actors, we find a corresponding way of, as it were, enacting, performing, experiencing the plays. Actors have often described the experience of performance as a coming together of the role, their own emotional state, and the audiences. Especially when, as in most theatrical performances before the 20th century, loud and demonstrative responses throughout the performance were the order of the day. In jazz, ballet, and opera, this custom still prevails. Enhancing the notion of an effective performance is a series of feats of virtuosity that deserve and get instant acknowledgement and encouragement. From the descriptions I'll be quoting, we usually get a sense of the community of feeling, the interpretive community, so to speak, created by and for performances. The private sensation of the reader here becomes a public sensation, and may also step over the mark to become sensational, that is, seeking to create emotional response at the expense either of continuity and consistency or consistency of effect. Sometimes there might even be a collision between reader and performer. Audiences knew their Shakespeare well enough by the end of the 19th century to take exception to omissions or mistakes. More than one actor was put right by voices offering the correct reading from the gallery. Dickens's Mr. Wopsle is a very famous case of this, whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer, the gallery takes up a kind of debating contest about the question. But none were quite as direct in their criticism, perhaps, as the infuriated purist encountered by Edwin Booth on the 23rd of April, 1879, in Chicago. In the dress circle, a dry goods clerk named Mark Gray sat comparing Booth's performance of Richard II with the text of Shakespeare's play. By Act V, apparently infuriated at the alterations Booth was introducing, Gray drew his pistol and fired two shots at Booth in an attempt, as one eyewitness put it, to kill the man that he could, as he thought, so murder Shakespeare. Applause, though, was actively encouraged both by the acting of individual performers and by the shaping of the scripts they used. The stage history of Shakespeare can appear to be littered with more or less opportunistic attempts by performers to engineer moments worthy of approbation. Garrick, for all his idolatry of Shakespeare, found Romeo and Juliet needed a proper funeral with dirge for the heroine and a death scene with both lovers conscious together before dying in the tomb that would afford the principals more opportunity for pathos. In Hamlet, however, there's a wonderful moment, by the way, in Garrick's version of Romeo and Juliet where Juliet sort of revived, brought down stage from the tomb by Garrick playing Romeo, and they have a love scene together that Garrick wrote, and then Garrick, as Romeo begins to come over all funny because, of course, he's taken the poison, and Juliet says, I think rather splendidly, was I awaked for this? Could have had another 5 minutes. Anyway, in Hamlet, however, Garrick thought the graveyard scene, and indeed most of the fifth act, too much of a not very good thing. And in one acting version, he hastened the play to a close by having Hamlet come back from England to encounter Laertes immediately after Ophelia's mad scene. In the 60 lines, only 60 lines that follow in this version, the fencing match is replaced by a somewhat hasty melee in which Hamlet kills Claudius, then falls fatally on Laertes' sword. He dies in Horatio's arms after joining his friend's hand with that of Laertes and then joining them to rule Denmark as a coalition. The queen, by the way, does not die but goes off stage and runs slightly mad. Rather than offer a catalogue of such alterations, which are revealing as to the needs and desires of actors and audiences in their time, I want to focus on moments within the accepted texts, so to speak, of the plays, where we have accounts of the sensations of playing and spectating. Very often we get that coalescence between the two, the sensation of taking the audience with them that actors so much look forward to and hope for. Thus, in the late 17th century, Thomas Betterton as Hamlet meets his father's ghost in Act 1, Scene 4. Collie Cibber relates that Joseph Addison had pointed out that restraint was the key to the beautiful speech, which is Angels and Ministers of Grace Defend Us, and so on. To quote Cibber, citing Addison, "The passion never rises beyond an almost breathless astonishment or an impatience limited by filial reverence to inquire into the suspected wrongs that may have raised him from his peaceful tomb, and a desire to know what a spirit so seemingly distressed might wish or enjoin a sorrowful son to execute towards his future quiet in the grave." This does sound excessively polite. "This was the light into which Betterton threw this scene, which he opened with a pause of mute amazement. Then, rising slowly to a solemn, trembling voice, he made the ghost equally terrible to the spectator as to himself. And in the descriptive part of the natural emotions which the ghastly vision gave him, the boldness of this expostulation was still governed by decency, manly but not braving, his voice never rising into that seeming outrage or wild defiance of what he naturally revered. Now, making the ghost equally terrible to the spectator as to himself is one kind of communication, presumably resulting in a rapt silence followed by applause at the end of the speech. For in Betterton's time, and for many years, and many decades, and a couple of centuries afterwards, it was not at all unusual to applaud a fine performance of a speech such as this, or to be or not to be, or whatever it might be. A more vivid example of audience response accompanying speech and action is afforded by Thomas Davies' account of David Garrick's first London performance on October the 19th, 1741, when Garrick appeared as Richard III at Goodman's Inn Fields. Mr. Garrick's easy and familiar, yet forcible style in speaking and acting, at first threw the critics into some hesitation concerning the novelty as well as the propriety of his manner. They had long been accustomed to an elevation of the voice with a sudden mechanical depression of its tones, guaranteed to excite admiration and to entrap applause. To the just modulation of the words and concurring expression of the features from the genuine workings of nature, they had long been strangers. Interestingly, the point here is not simply that Garrick, like most new actors, seemed more natural than his predecessors, but that the customary techniques for eliciting applause, claptraps as they were called, were missing. The spectators' doubts, writes Davies, were turned into surprise and astonishment, from which they relieved themselves by loud and reiterated applause. Interesting description of the way the spectators' feelings work. When information was brought to Richard, the Duke of Buckingham was taken, Garrick's look and action when he pronounced the words, "off with his head, so much for Buckingham," was so significant and important from his visible enjoyment of the incident that several loud shouts of approbation proclaimed the triumph of the actor and satisfaction of the audience. The death of Richard was accompanied by the loudest gratulations of applause. Garrick was still using Cibber's improved text with the famous line, "off with his head, so much for Buckingham," that for over a century later was still associated with the role. In an article in Sketches by Boz on private theatres where actors pay to perform Shakespearean parts, Dickens enumerates the cash value of the various points in the role to the amateurs who paid to perform it. I think this is the line that was worth a whole guinea. I'm not quite sure. And the effect is not unlike that still persists, for example, in the traditions of kabuki, where the execution of a high emotional moment, the mire by an actor, the pose, the sudden turn of the voice, accompanied by musical emphasis, is responded to by their supporters in the audience who shout the name of the actor out loud. We don't do that much at Stratford. But it's, can you imagine sort of people shouting, "McKellen, McKellen!" Well, maybe. Some 70 years later, Edmund Kean's performance in the same role was being described in terms that indicate an even stronger bond between actor, role, and audience, a romantic transport of enthusiasm into the feelings of an heroic villain. In the heroic parts, wrote Thomas Barnes in The Examiner on 18th of February 1817, Kean animated every spectator with his own feelings. When he exclaimed as Richard that 1,000 hearts were swelling in his bosom, the house shouted to express their accordance to a truth so nobly exemplified by the energy of the voice and the grandeur of his mien. So what is the audience applauding here? It seems as though the exalted degree of excellence that they're applauding, in another passage of Barnes, describing Richard after all, might be that of Richard, that exaltation, or Edmund Kean, but more likely it's an amalgam of them both, together with the audience's sense of itself as participating in the event that, in which the actor is a representative for them, and a sensational one, and a sensational representative at that. This is the double and sometimes triple effect analysed by Richard Dyer in his studies of film stardom. In The Wizard of Oz, we are watching Judy Garland as Dorothy, as well as Dorothy herself, plus some other being we can call Judy stroke Dorothy. And for some of us, there's the Judy stroke Dorothy that's in all of us that we're also applauding. Now, in the case, or whoever it might be, there's a degree, a kind of identification. In the case of some actors, we have evidence of a gap between the actor's sense of what he or she has done and the audience's. The diaries of William Charles McCreadie, a remarkably fine-tuned and neurotic actor in the middle of the 19th century, are filled with a sense of what he and his art ought to be, both intellectually and socially, but there are also pages of comments on his not achieving that goal, such as this, 2nd of January, 1833. My performance this evening of Macbeth afforded me a striking evidence of the necessity there is for thinking over my characters previous to playing and establishing by practice, if necessary, the particular modes of each scene and important passage. So come on, Stanislavski. I acted with much energy, but could not, as I sometimes can when the audience is in rapt attention, listen to my own voice and feel the truth of its tones. 2 days later, he thought his acting was crude and coarse. So, no identification of myself with the scene, and what increased my chagrin on the subject, some persons in the pit gave frequent vent to unmerited applause and misplaced admiration. The consciousness of unmerited applause makes it quite painful and humiliating to me. McCreadie really has got problems. Helen Fawcett, whose acting partnership with him during the 30s and early 1840s was close enough to foster rumours of a liaison, recalled her emotions during the statue scene in The Winter's Tale. His passionate joy, as Leontes, at finding Hermione really alive, seemed beyond control. Now he was prostrate at her feet, then enfolding her in his arms. I had a slight veil or covering over my head and neck, supposed to make the statue look older. This fell off in an instant. The hair, which came unbound and fell on my shoulders, was reverently kissed and caressed. The whole change was so sudden, so overwhelming, that I suppose I cried out hysterically, for he whispered to me, "Don't be frightened, my child, don't be frightened, control yourself." And all this went on during a tumult of applause that sounded like a storm of hail. Would a modern audience respond that way, however, to whatever the performance was like, to that moment in The Winter's Tale? Astonishment, surprise, one hopes for, one hopes they don't know. It's not really a statue, but still. There's no reason to doubt the veracity of Macready's or Helen Fawcett's accounts of their feelings and the audience's responses. Macready's diaries, though, give plentiful evidence, which Fawcett's more published writings don't, of the range of possible responses to a given role as performed by an actor to whom it was part of his or her stock in trade. My own experience, which I'm sure many people share, of going round to see actors after a performance has included many instances of the following exchange. "Were you in tonight, then?" "Oh, yes, and it was wonderful." "Ah, you should have been here on Tuesday, though." Many of the most vivid phrases of reviewers acquire a representative quality. Thus, for example, James Agate on Sir Donald Wolfit as Richard III in 1941, crying, a horse, my kingdom for a horse," was agony made vocal. Agate wrote, "The spectator, no longer concerned whether Richard is a good king or a bad, is appalled at this cry of a man about to die on his feet. Baffled enjoyment of his well-laid schemes, vengeance on Richmond, the fury of a trapped animal, all these are merged in the hoarse scream which still rings in my ears." But the moment one begins to read any critic's accounts of the same actor, one after another, rather than separated by the decent intervals of their original appearance in newspapers, one begins to imagine a kind of conspiracy between what the reviewers enjoy celebrating and what the actor actually does. Another hybrid is constructed. X as Y sees her or him and reports her or him. Kenneth Tynan's remarkable descriptions of Laurence Olivier's vocal effects are a case in point. As Titus Andronicus in 1959 writes Tynan, "One hears great cries which, like all of this actor's best effects, seem to have been dredged up from an ocean bed of fatigue. One recognized, though one had never heard it before, the noise made in its last extremity by the cornered human soul." As Coriolanus in 1959, Tynan wrote, "The voice is soft steel that can chill and cut or melt and scorch." Here it's difficult to restrain oneself from quoting the whole of Tynan's description of the spectacular, sensational death fall of the Titanic fool, Coriolanus. But the sensation of the voice, as Tynan describes it, we'll have to do for this evening. The dark imprint of Olivier's stage presence is something one forgets only with an effort, but the voice is a lifelong possession of those who have heard it at its best. It sounds distinct and barbaric across the valley of the centuries, like a horn calling to the hunt or the neigh of a battle-maddened charger. Those of us who saw and heard some of Olivier's performances or have studied them, what's left of them, so to speak, can testify to a quality that Tynan celebrates and describes, as nearly as one could expect him to. The question whether or not, speaking in terms of historians' work, we can hope to recreate the impact Olivier made is, of course, a moot point, despite the abundant film, videotape, and sound recordings of him. We can, however, though, locate Olivier's career in the 20th century construction of stage heroism and its significance in relation to the material the actor was working with. That's a feasible project for a historian working with this kind of evidence. The example of this great actor does raise the issue of the sensational moment in a production and its relation to the whole. Is it altogether bad to be taken out of the illusion and then put back into it more forcefully, as those 19th century audiences were quite happy to be? In the 19th century, an actor's points, moments of great emphasis and inventiveness by which she or he made their mark on great roles, could be as sensational as Olivier's famous death fall in Coriolanus, but they also serve as indications of emphasis and interpretation. They're interpreted also as signs of identity within a cultural system. As Othello, for example, the Italian actors Tommaso Salvini and Ernesto Rossi made the hero's death particularly gruesome. Salvini died, and I quote, by hacking open his throat with a curved knife, hacking and hewing with savage energy and imitating the noise that escaping blood and air make together when the windpipe is severed. Rossi also emitted spasmodic gurgling sounds as of a person choked by blood. These were thought to be actors who, as Italians, in the northern view of things, had access to passions denied to those from cooler climates. But this became a very serious matter when it was disputed that they could or could not play Hamlet adequately because they, as Latins, could not have the restraint. By contrast, the English actor Macready brought out the pathos of the dying moments. After falling, he motions to be raised, his wish being complied with, he hastily staggers towards the bed, supporting himself by the walls and furniture of the room, ejaculates faintly her name, just gazes on Desdemona's face and falls dead upon the floor. Such performance points would have seemed coherent in the context of an actor's overall interpretation of the role. But since the beginning of the 20th century, audiences have come to expect such things to be subordinated to directors rather than actors' overall view of the play. Now I want to turn to some sensational public events connected with theatrical performances. These have usually been occasioned by disputes that go far beyond the issues of performance itself. Some non-Shakespearean examples may be relevant. The uproar that greeted the first performances of Victor Hugo's Hernani at the Odeon in Paris in 1830, the uproar was as much a generational and social dispute as an aesthetic protest. The bohemian, ultra-romantic behavior and dress of the supporters of Hugo, prominent among them being Théophile Gautier, in his scarlet satin waistcoat and mane of hair, were les jeunes gens, the young people, and they were championing Hugo against the defenders of neoclassicism, whose age and social status were as much a part of the dispute as their taste in versification and the organization of moral certainty in plays. The disruption of the premiere of Richard Wagner's Tannhäuser in Paris in 1861 was also a dangerous combination of aesthetic, national, and social prejudices. There were three premiere performances, no less, at the Paris Opera in March 1861. But Wagner had insisted that the scene inside the Venusberg, in which Venus, no less, tries to restrain Tannhäuser from being virtuous and going elsewhere, with its rather sexy ballet, must remain in place at the opening of the opera, where we all know and love it, in defiance of the custom in Paris that dictated that ballet should always be at the beginning of the second act. This was because the members of the Jockey Club many of whom kept ballet dancers as mistresses, were in the habit of dining before they rolled up at the opera in time for their favorite's appearance in Act Two. Many of them were also legitimists in political terms, who took the occasion as a pretext for showing their dislike of Wagner and Princess Pauline and of Germans and Austrians in general. And they'd also embarrass Emperor Louis Napoleon and the Empress Eugenie. Armed, we are told, with hunting whistles and flageolets, which they blew on command, they reduced the carefully prepared presentations to shambles. Whistling, hissing, shouts and laughter filled the great hall. When others protested, fights broke out. One more non-Shakespearean example may be relevant. Consider the violent scenes in the auditorium at the first performance of the ballet The Rite of Spring in 1911, also in Paris. Jean Cocteau remarked that all the elements of scandal were present. The smart audience in tails and tulle, diamonds and ospreys was interspersed with the suits and bandeaux of the artistic crowd. The latter would applaud novelty simply to show their contempt for people in the boxes. Innumerable shades of snobbery, super snobbery and inverted snobbery were represented. Something for everyone. The audience played the role, said Cocteau, that was written for it. Between the two scenes, the police were called in vain to seek out and eject the most violent demonstrators, but it was in vain. No sooner had the curtain risen on the trembling girls of Part Two, their tilted heads propped on the back of their hands, like that, more or less, than a voice called out, "A doctor," and another, "A dentist," and then another one called out, "Two dentists." There was laughter, shouting, and whistling. Battle was renewed. One smart lady in an orchestra box stood up and slapped the face of the man in the box next door, who was hissing. Her escort rose and cards were exchanged between the two men, and the duel was fought the next day. Another society woman spat in the face of one of the demonstrators. Florent Schmidt, a radical, shouted at the boxes, "Taisez-vous les garces du 16e," which the London equivalent might be, "Shut up, you Kensington bitches." I suppose Fifth Avenue will have to do for or whatever. These were turning points in the arts of the theatre, and they derived much of their impact from the confluence of cultural politics with wider social politics of the time. The phrase, though, Shakespeare Revolution, coined or first used memorably by J.L. Stein in an important study of 20th century Shakespeare interpretation, is by comparison something of a hyperbole. It has, after all, been a relatively bloodless revolution. Such turning points as Granville Barker's or Peter Brook's productions of A Midsummer Night's Dream and were not attended with civil disturbance, however momentous they may have been. Usually one can identify points of coherence between the revolutionary stage production, however, and the social occasion that it's part of. Thus, the reception of Romeo and Juliet was indelibly affected in the mid-1950s and affected for the better by the production of West Side Story, as if the musical acted as a set of jumper leads from post-war or post-post-war society's energies to the play. There have also been Shakespearean occasions whose impact can be described as sensational in their participation, not always intentional on the part of their creators, in the political life of their time. Two such occasions in the last part of this talk you'll be pleased to hear, because I always believe in telling people it's nearly over. Two such occasions will stand, so don't reach under for the coats yet and keep the cell phones off. Two such occasions will, because it's not, go, well, it will, anyway. Two such occasions will stand for many others, a Macbeth in New York in the 19th century and a Coriolanus in Paris in the 20th. The Astor Place riot in New York on the 10th of May 1849 was an extraordinary combination of artistic and political factors. The cultural dimension of the rivalry between New York's poorest and the Europe-oriented upper class, the codfish aristocracy of what was supposedly, if you read the label, a classless society. It's the point where Shakespeare meets the gangs of New York, effectively. A recent history of New York points out that by the 1850s, New York's predominantly Anglo-Protestant middle and upper classes would confront a reconstituted working class of whom better than three-fourths were, in their terms, foreigners. The aggressive, brutalized Bowery boys had their own cultural idols and their own theaters, and for that matter, their own claims to Shakespeare. The Astor Place Opera House, with its pretensions to gentility and high culture, its starched shirt dress code, was a symbol of everything they hated in the exploitative upper class. A large proportion of the more recently arrived labouring classes were Irish, refugees from the potato famine. They can hardly be expected to celebrate the arrival of England's eminent tragedian. William Charles Macready, for it is he, the unhappy, neurotic Macready, worried about the status of his profession and his own effectiveness, but also one of the greatest actors of his time, had for some 20 years sustained a none too friendly rivalry with Edwin Forrest, an American actor remarkable more for force than for subtlety. In 1846, during a performance of Hamlet in Edinburgh, Forrest had unwisely hissed one of Macready's cherished points, those moments of emphasis recognized as an actor's hallmark, their sort of calling card. At the end of the play scene, when Hamlet's convinced he has forced his murderous uncle to betray his guilt publicly, Macready used to twirl a handkerchief over his head as he executed a dance step across the stage and chanted, "Why let the stricken deer go weep?" In hissing this, when Macready might expect a round of applause, Forrest was showing his contempt for what he considered an effete gesture. He compounded the offence by claiming publicly that hissing was an audience's right. "A salutary and wholesome corrective of the abuses of the stage," were his words. Given Forrest's pretensions to be a representative alpha male, one of his favourite roles was the title role of the gladiator, the hissing also implied effeminacy in the more intellectual and sensitive Macready, and by extension in this kind of English acting. There was a sexual as well as political dimension to the affair. When Macready appeared on the 7th of May 1849 at the Astor Place Opera House in New York, a venue associated by these militant Democrats with the refined tastes of the codfish aristocracy, Forrest was starring in a production of the same play at a more popular theatre. Forrest's performance was greeted with tumultuous applause. The line, Macbeth's line, "What rhubarb senna or what purgative drug will scour these English hence," the audience roared and cheered for. Meanwhile, Macready failed to get beyond Act Three. He wrote in his diary, "Copper cents were thrown. Some struck me, 4 or 5 eggs, a great many apples, nearly if not quite a peck of potatoes, lemons, pieces of wood, a bottle of asafoetida, which splashed my own dress, smelling, of course, most horribly." It was when chairs were being thrown from the upper gallery that Macready decided that he'd fulfilled the terms of his contract. Despite all this, a petition signed by 46 leading New Yorkers, including Washington Irving and Herman Melville, persuaded Macready to continue with his engagement. On the 10th of May, with 1,800 spectators inside the theatre and allegedly, I mean, who's counting, but allegedly 10,000 outside ready to riot, he appeared again as Macbeth. As the performance continued, the uproar outside became more and more violent. Paving stones flung through windows, and General Hall, in charge of the militia, ordered them to defend the theatre with a whiff of grapeshot. They misheard his order to fire above the heads of the crowd and levelled the guns at the crowd. Recent estimates suggest that 22 were killed and 180 wounded or injured. Now, the Astor Place riot has been described as a struggle for power and authority within theatrical space by Lawrence Levine. It was not, of course, primarily a dispute over the finer points of Shakespearean interpretation, but it doesn't indicate not so much what dire events from trivial causes spring, as how relatively trivial matters may be harnessed to very dire events in themselves, or to major social shifts, schisms, and fault lines. It does illustrate the significance also of Shakespeare in popular culture in America in the 19th century. Those Bowery boys knew their Shakespeare. The defense of the people's right to culture at their own prices and on their own terms, the sense of nationally acclaimed artists as symbols of nationhood and of manhood in the case of Forrest, and the repulse of what might be seen as a British attempt to claim such ownership, this made the New York performance of Macbeth into a casus belli. In Paris in 1933 to 1934, a version of Coriolanus was produced at the Comédie Française. It was a spectacular production with a cast of 231, including extras, at the principal state theatre. And given the political circumstances in Paris, it was inevitable that certain passages might be taken up as cues for a demonstration, either by right-wing or by socialist or communist elements in the audience in this extremely polarised political climate of mid-1930s France. In fact, most of the 52 performances between the opening on 9th of January and the close on 30th of November 1934 were peaceful. At a handful of occasions, there were interruptions from the audience. But it was the performances in January 1934 that were the main focus of attention. The right-wing factions responded to the play as if it were an attack on the allegedly corrupt Chamber of Deputies. The most sensational of these demonstrations, however, arose not from the play itself, but from President Daladier's inept handling of the crisis that had erupted around the Stavisky corruption scandal and the simultaneous accusations of police complicity with fascists. At a loss for a better strategy, Daladier had removed the intendant of the Comédie Française, the artistic director, in order to manufacture a safe public office for the elderly chief of the secret police, the Sûreté, Monsieur Thomé. In other words, you take the national... It's as though you say, you know, to the current director of the National Theatre, I'm sorry, but we've got to find somewhere to put the head of MI5, so he's going to do your job. The intendant, Monsieur Fabre, asked for reasons and was told, and one has to imagine, forgive it if it sounds like a parody, a sort of Gallic but very official shrug here saying, n'y en a pas, on a besoin de votre poste. No, there aren't any, we just need your job. As one actress asked, don't they know the Comédie Française is a theatre? At the performance of Coriolan on 4th of February 1934, there was an interruption from a speaker in favour of Fabre, followed by what David Daniel in his account of the affairs calls a sensational declaration of support for this from the entire house. Poor Thomé watched helplessly from a box. At the end of the play, the safety curtain was brought down, and the actor who played Coriolanus appealed to the audience to leave the theatre. Outside, there was a massive demonstration on Fabre's behalf, and at 5 p.m. 2 days later, he was told that he was to be reinstated. As David Daniel points out, the real point of the story is not the hijacking of the play by political factions, but the public's protest at an absurd piece of political manoeuvring and its insistence on Shakespeare produced as well as was thought possible. But this would not have been possible, this conjuncture would not have been possible without the political content of the play Coriolan, Coriolanus, without that sense of popular uprising, resistance to it, and the fascistic hero, as one faction interpreted the play, combined with the situation in the country at the time. These are heavy matters, and they're heavy matters that I was going to end on. Except that, in conclusion, I want to step back from this more directly and vividly political, social Shakespeare and return to the less momentous kind of sensation that I started out from. That produced by the unexpected eruption of Shakespeare into other kinds of art. YouTube is full of examples from episodes in science fiction sagas to lager commercials of this kind of procedure. Pierre Bourdieu has commented on it incisively, but let's leave him out of it. I want to end with Shakespeare's part in the ending of one of the cinema's greatest achievements. We were in an apartment before in London in the 1920s and 30s. Now we're in San Francisco in the early 1940s. For years, an ill-assorted but vividly entertaining group of obsessive personalities have been pursuing a chimera, and finally, it has eluded them just as they thought they had attained their goal of riches. In the process, not only have lives been lost, but a profoundly deceitful and at the same time profoundly attractive woman has seduced and betrayed a cynical but humane private detective. He hands her over to the police, together with the chimera in question, and we hear a line, the last of the movie, a touch of Shakespearean sensation that John Huston added to the dialogue that he was taking wholesale from Dashiell Hammett's novel. So we now end with an ending, which is my ending as well. No, wait, because...
Hello, Tom. Got him?
Got him.
Swell. Here's another one for you. She killed Miles. Oh, and I've got some exhibits. The boy's guns, one of Cairo's, and $1,000 bill I was supposed to be bribed with. And this black statuette here that all the fuss was about. What's the matter with your little playmate? He looks brokenhearted. And I bet when he heard Gutman's story, he thought he had me.
Cut it out, Sam.
Well, should we be getting down to the hall?
Harry. What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Huh?